Thank you, Howard.
Being an economist seems to be a very hazardous occupation here. Being an economist for the coal industry is doubly hazardous. It's a very great pleasure to be here. Jerry, one comment. It's tons of coal equivalent, which is understandable to everyone, rather than barrels of oil. This year, the United States will produce about 633 million tons of bituminous coal and lignite, representing about a 7.1% increase over 1973 production. If we in fact do this, 1974 will be the best production year for coal in the history of the industry, exceeding 1947 when we produced approximately 630 million tons. Utilities will remain our largest customer in 1974, consuming approximately 403 million tons, or 63% of the total consumption. The steel industry will consume approximately 95 million tons, industrial consumption will be approximately 73 million, and exports approximately 58 million tons. To produce 633 million tons, the bituminous coal industry will deploy a capital base of approximately $4 to $5 billion and approximately 150 to 170,000 men. It will call upon the railroads to haul approximately 65 to 70% of this tonnage and provide the railroads with the largest single source of commodity revenue they have. The bulk of the production, almost 88%, will come from the traditional mining areas in the Appalachian region and the Middle West. But in 1974, for the first time, we are seeing the beginning of the impact on Western coal production. In 1974, slightly more than 50% of our coal will be mined by deep mining methods and slightly less than 50% by surface mining methods. The bulk of our coal, as I said, will move by rail, but electric high voltage transmission and barge lines will move a sizable part. In addition, there is currently operating in the United States one coal slurry pipeline. That's the industry of today. My thesis, if I have one in this discussion, is that the industry of today will, in the face of the demands as sketched by Jerry Gunning and others, gradually fade out, and the coal industry of tomorrow will be unrecognizable. Let's look then, at where the industry, the coal industry of tomorrow, will go. By 1985, we estimate that coal demand in the United States will increase by 2 to 3 times. The basic question which the United States of America must face is whether or not the demand side will meet an equilibrium on the supply side. We assume, for the sake of discussion, that supply and demand will come into balance in the period between now and 1985, and that by that year, we will be producing approximately 1.2 to 1.5 billion tons. We must also assume, and this is a somewhat shaky assumption, that the exogenous variables, the governmental and public variables, surrounding the production and sale of coal will shift from the current rate, or from the current neutral or negative rate, to strongly expansionary, and that the coal industry will in fact be able to grow at the demand level we're talking about. Now, if we are to achieve a growth rate that will permit us to have between 1.2 and 1.5 billion tons by 1985, we must look at the ingredients of such growth. Today at the luncheon speech, the speaker pointed to a study by the National Academy of Engineering, which is a very excellent one. Although I don't agree with all of the things it says, it does give us an example of what we have to do in order to reach these targets. It suggests for the coal industry that between now and starting now, in 1985, if we are to achieve a doubling of capacity, the coal industry must develop 140 2 million ton per year underground mines in the east, 30 new 2 million ton surface mines in the east, and 100 new 5 million tons per year surface mines in the west. The coal industry between now and 1985 must recruit and train 80,000 coal miners in the east and 45,000 coal miners in the west. and manufacture 140 new 100 cubic yard shovels and drag lines and build 2,400 continuous miners. But this is just the first part, because coal on the ground is merely the beginning. Before the coal can be used, it must be transported to the point of use. The National Academy gives us an idea of the magnitude of the problem of that when it suggests that our logistical system must, between now and 1985, construct 60 new 2 million ton per year eastern rail barge systems of 100 to 500 miles each, 70 new 3 million ton per year western rail barge systems of 1,000 to 1,200 miles each, 4 new 25 million ton per year Surrey pipelines of 1,000 miles each, and for those of you who receive coal on the Penn Central Railroad, manufacture 8,000 railroad locomotives and 150,000 hopper cars. What I am sketching is a brand new industry, and it tends to minimize the total effect of what we're talking about. It tends to quantify a job that an industry has that exceeds anything that the industry has ever been able to do, and leads to the major conclusion of my talk, which is, very simply, the past is not prologue. In the past, the bituminous coal industry struggled for survival. All of our actions, all of our efforts, and all of our contacts with the outside world were keyed to a single overriding objective: survival. Today we work for growth, growth with a dimension that was never before possible, growth that imposes responsibilities and challenges that are radically different from those of the past. The consequences of failure to grow, for us in coal, for you in the utilities, and indeed for the nation as a whole, are frightening in the extreme. Indeed, in a way, the emerging relationship between national welfare and the welfare of the coal industry is a sobering and somewhat startling development. And thus it is essential for us to look at our future and to examine the ingredients of that future. First of all, it is quite clear that the coal industry itself must of necessity change, perhaps radically. And that in part is the challenge for us. It is a challenge for which in many ways we are ill-prepared, but a challenge we can no longer ignore. But it is also quite evident that an America which needs coal must also change its view of the industry, a view that all too often is also rooted in the past, a view which must come to accept coal as a natural resource to be developed. From this beginning, from this change on our view of ourselves and of the people's view of us, can come the development of a coal industry truly responsive to the needs of the last quarter of this century. First, therefore, there must be a national commitment to the development of America's coal resource, to take a secondary industry and to make it into a primary one. Such a commitment can be made in two ways. First, there must be positive encouragement to coal expansion. Legislation aimed at coal expansion for power generation and other uses must be passed and carried forth. Tax incentives must be granted. And the public recognition by responsible government officials that coal is, in fact, now central to the national welfare. There must also be a removal of some of the negative factors which currently inhibit coal expansion. I'll mention only two. First, there must be responsible surface mining legislation. Today in the House of Representatives, there's being debated two pieces of legislation which, to one degree or another, would place restrictions on the expansion and even continuation of surface mining in the country. It's not my position or the position of the coal industry that federal surface mining legislation is not needed. It is. But it is very definitely our position that federal surface mining legislation must take account of the need to extract the more than 30% of the coal reserve of the United States, which is represented by our surface mining reserves. Obviously, a coal industry that's striving to grow simply cannot endure the potential impact of legislation which could wipe out much of our current capacity and which could inhibit, today and for the future, investment in the development of America's surface coal resources. In saying this, I am not suggesting a retreat from needed surface mining legislation, only that there must be a recognition of the need to reconcile the dichotomy which must be resolved in meeting America's pollution or surface mining legislation. Secondly, there must be a recognition of the new situation which confronts us in terms of air pollution regulations. Next year, if the current air pollution, current Clean Air Act of 1970 is not amended, approximately 30% to 40% of the current coal consumption by the electric utilities will be wiped out. It is simply impossible. It's simply impossible to conceive that these regulations, which were passed in an era of energy adequacy, can survive in a period when energy adequacy is no longer assured. It is simply impossible to believe that the responsible leaders of the Congress and the responsible environmental groups in the United States will not recognize that the vast reserves of high sulfur coal, as well as the vast reserves of low sulfur coal, cannot be brought to a position where they can make their maximum contribution to the energy supply situation in the United States. Finally, there must be a recognition on the part of the federal government and on the part of the state governments that the development of coal is in the positive national interest, that the development of coal, both by private industry and its consumption, both by private industry and by the various other public consumers of coal, is needed if we are to attain the type of progress in the economic area and the social area that we have had. Given that, there will be, in my opinion, the type of capital investment in the coal industry, the type of development in the coal industry which is essential to achieve the targets that we've been talking about. With this, the coal industry can begin to raise the more than $20 billion we're going to need in capital investment by 1985. With this, coal companies and other consumers, or coal companies and the consumers of coal, will begin to make the type of front-end investment that we will need if, in fact, we are to achieve the targets over the next 10 years. And I would point out that if you're going to develop an underground mine or even a surface mine, you must now begin now in order to achieve production from that mine in 3 to 5 years. With that, businessmen can make entrepreneurial judgments based on reasonable assumptions that their investment, in fact, can work over its projected lifetime. And the investment which we need, the $20 billion or more, which we need, will begin to flow to the industry. With that national commitment, then, we of the coal industry can begin to make those changes in our industry which will be needed in order to construct the new coal industry of the 1970s and the 1980s. And there are several critical areas that we must address. First, it's quite obvious that manpower is the key to the future of coal mining. Within 10 years, we will have a practically new workforce. Almost 50% of our present employment is over age 45 and thus nearing the end of their careers. At the other end of the spectrum, more than a quarter, between 25% and 30% of the people in the coal mining industry are less than 30 and represent the future insofar as coal is concerned. They also represent something that Jerry Gunning mentioned, the challenge of dealing with people with high expectations and no real remembrance or no real memory for the difficult times. The manpower dilemma is not limited to rank and file coal miners. Perhaps more critical is the critical shortage of frontline supervisors and mining engineers. This problem is intensified by two factors. First, the added responsibility of these men under various state and federal laws, and the increasing complexity in dealing with a young and very, very aggressive workforce. And second, the paucity or lack of a potential manpower resource in the 20 to 45 age group, the normal age where experience and maturity combine to make the best supervisors. Added to the manpower challenge is the increasing requirement for training and certification under the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act. It appears that tomorrow's coal miners, and this in itself represents a dramatic and radical change from the past, it appears that tomorrow's coal miners will spend a great deal of their time in classrooms, will spend a great deal of their time being trained and retrained, will spend a great deal of their time undergoing formal education of one type or another, totally unlike their fathers and grandfathers. Beyond these particular problems dealing with the manpower question is the awesome task of molding a coal workforce motivated to growth. Involved is not only the attraction of sufficient manpower, which is really a relatively simple task, but more importantly, its retention and motivation. Historically, the desperate struggle for survival in coal was the adhesive force, especially during the post-war period from 1950 through the late 1960s. The weakening of that element, coupled with the grandfather-grandson demographic makeup of the industry, is a challenge to coal for the next decade. Secondly, research is essential. This year, the Office of Coal Research will spend almost $300 million on coal R&D, all of it in the area of consumption. The Bureau of Mines budget exceeds $100 million, partly in consumption, and more significantly, in mining technology. Both are desperately needed. If the coal industry is viewed as a system which begins at the mine and ends at the utility stack, there are technological deficiencies at every point along the system. In mining, we have a relatively obsolete technology. The coal industry of the future must have new mining systems, including the ability to provide for remote control extraction and continuous movement of the product away from the face. We must be better able to protect our people from the inherent hazards of mining, including methane, dust, falls of roof and rib, etc. Finally, as we go deeper for Appalachian coal, and as we begin to look at the eventual underground recovery of Western seams, we must find technology to permit us to do so. In the consumption area, we also see the results of technological lag. Our best power plants are 40% efficient. The first gasification units will be based upon German technology. SO2 scrubber systems are just in their very infancy. And technologies like solvent refined coal, fluidized bed combustion, MHD, combined cycle, are all in the very early pilot plant stage or even still in the laboratory stage. Fortunately, R&D efforts are now being accelerated, funded in part by the government, in part by various industries. But such efforts take time, and for the present, coal and its consumers must look to what we have, to the technologies that are present, to the conventional ways of producing and burning coal. Transportation also looms as a major bottleneck. Moving more than 1 billion tons of coal will be a major logistical task. On certain lines, particularly the bankrupt lines in the Northeast, these have become and will continue to be a critical impediment to growth. Even with the increased movement by barge, the coming age of the pipeline, and more mine mouth generation, the railroads will continue to be the prime mover of coal. I might point out that at one point we were estimating the problem, of moving very large volumes of coal from the West. And one of our company presidents, we would never do this in National Coal, but company presidents have certain privileges, suggested that if the movement of coal from the West grew at the rate it was predicted, every 30 days in Sioux City, Iowa, the trains would stop for 30 seconds to let people across the tracks. This is the type of problem we're talking about. The need is going to accelerate. The demand for coal and the tie-in between coal and our logistical component will make it essential that the coal industry and the railroad transportation industry work much more closely together. What we're talking about then is the building of an entirely new coal industry. If we didn't have a coal industry in the United States, we'd have to invent one. We'd have to create one. If we didn't have a coal industry in the United States, we would have to go through whatever we had to go through to form it. Coal represents more than 80% of our fossil fuel resources. It is wealth in the ground, but it is something more important than that. Coal represents the continued ability of the United States to pursue both our economic, our political, and our military objectives without undue influences of foreign countries. The coal industry, as it moves into the 80s and into the 90s, will not be the coal industry that most of us have known. In many respects, it will be a better coal industry. In most respects, it will be a more challenging industry. And to those of us who are in coal, the challenge is no longer parochial, but rather national. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. And now Mr. Searle will bring us up to date on the oil situation.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. It is, I'm sure, simply a coincidence that we're meeting at a center of make-believe and fantasy, and that the whole matter of fuel supply in the last year has assumed some unreal qualities. I missed Bob Sandberg's talk this noon, which I assumed was excellent. I'll have to talk to him when we get back to Palo Alto about what I understand was some comment about economists. I'll leave it to your own judgment, though, as to what caused you the real trouble. If it's the economists, or if it's the communications, the piles of paper in your inbox and the telephones. That's surely my trouble, the communications, not the economists. And I've got to agree with Mr. Gunning, it's barrels of oil, Joe, not tons of coal. In considering oil supply for power generation, one must place considerable emphasis on crude oil supply. If there are shortages of crude oil, this means almost certainly shortages of oil for power generation. Oil for power generation is not likely to receive a high priority in a period of shortages. Witness, for example, the recent attempts to convert plants which had been converted from coal to oil back to coal again in the recent times of shortage. I was going to give you a few remarks here about the future growth of electricity. Mr. Gunning's done a good job with that, so I will skip that. But let me point out that in the past, a lot of places in our economy, and I think in power generation to some extent too, we've tended to use oil as the swing fuel, the fuel which you could get more or less of rather easily. That may not be true in the future, and the oil requirements are very uncertain then, because I think the electricity requirements are somewhat uncertain. Certainly looking out towards 1985, if electricity falls short, there will be a real tendency, short of projections, a real tendency to continue to load the big nuclear plants and the baseload coal-fired plants and to cut back on oil consumption to the extent that we can. I would like to approach the subject of oil first by talking about expectations for oil supply in general and oil for power generation in particular as they existed before the Arab embargo, and then to look at how these expectations should now be modified in the light of the embargo and subsequent developments. Reports published by the National Petroleum Council as part of their study of the U.S. energy outlook may be taken as typical of pre-embargo expectations. The National Petroleum Council identified four main supply options by which its intermediate demand case might be met. The role of oil differed considerably in the four cases, even though total energy consumption was the same. At the one extreme was the option under which national policy resulted in a continuation of the decline in the development of domestic energy resources, a decline which has been going on for well over a decade. Under this option, foreign oil was expected to make up for an increasing deficiency in domestic energy output, not only of oil, but of all other energy forms. As a result, oil consumption in 1985 was the highest, in this case, of any of the four cases. 50% of total energy consumed was consumed as oil. At the other extreme was the case where the U.S. made a determined effort to increase domestic energy output. This is the case that now most clearly approximates the situation under Project Independence, although national policy, as Joe Brennan has noted, is still somewhat ambiguous about the development of domestic supply. In this National Petroleum Council case, oil would supply only 34% of energy consumption in 1985 due to increased output of coal and other fuels. The Electricity Task Force of the National Petroleum Council study analyzed the sources of energy for electric power generation. This task force found that oil consumed for electric power generation in 1985 might be anywhere from 200% of the 1970 consumption level to nearly 800% of the 1970 level. This is a very wide range indeed. It reflects both some technological uncertainty and the fact that we have tended to use oil as swing fuel in the United States, one that could be called upon on relatively short notice to make up the deficiency in the supply of other fuels or to meet surges in consumption. The task force judged that the most likely level of utility oil consumption in 1985 would be from 200% to 300% of the 1970 level. A 1973 pre-embargo study by L.G. Cook of Esso Research and Engineering tended to support the oil consumption levels toward the middle of the NPC range. According to Cook's study, not only would there be a rapid growth in oil consumption by electric utilities, but much of the growth in this consumption would be for distillate-type fuel oil rather than for residual oil. Cook expected the use of distillate oil by electric utilities would grow from less than 100,000 barrels per day in 1973 to 3 million barrels per day in 1985 and 6 million barrels per day in 1990. To this must be added, of course, use of residual oil, which, as was mentioned, ran 1.5 million barrels per day last year, and which, under pre-embargo circumstances, would have increased through the years, and probably still will to some extent. Cook's estimate of 3 million barrels of distillate oil consumption in 1985 was based on the ordering by utilities of large amounts of combination gas turbine, steam turbine capacity to meet the intermediate load and to ensure against shortages of capacity in nuclear and coal-fired plants coming on the line. It appears from Cook's charts that over 20% of total capacity in 1985 would be in combination units. I don't have much feel whether this is realistic or not. Probably most of you are in a better position to judge it than I am. It's a definite change, though, from the past. Cook does point out, correctly I believe, that it will be increasingly uneconomic and unwise technically to use large nuclear base units and supercritical fossil fuel plants to serve the intermediate or swing load. In the past, older fossil units could be used to serve this load, but this will be less and less feasible in the future. And there is a real question as to how this load will indeed be supplied. Oil or natural gas is, from a technical standpoint, a logical choice for the capacity to serve this intermediate load. But as was mentioned here, gas is increasingly being phased out of the power plant market, and whether or not oil will be available is a major question. The Arab oil embargo has changed or at least clouded the outlook for oil. With regard to availability of oil supply, ignoring price for the moment, drilling for oil in the United States is increasing as rapidly as the supply of labor, steel, and drilling rigs will allow. As best I can tell, activity is not being hampered by any lack of places to drill. This does not mean that domestic oil supply will increase particularly in the next few years. Without any new drilling, domestic oil production would decline at the rate of perhaps 10% per year. It may take several years to get domestic drilling up to the level where it can offset the natural decline in production and result in a net increase in output. The future of domestic oil is still subject to many political and environmental uncertainties, just as is the case with coal. Since many of the better prospects for new oil are on federal lands, federal leasing policy is a key element. Although the rate of leasing offshore areas was inadequate a few years ago, the Department of Interior is moving towards a near-term goal of leasing 10 million acres a year. This should be adequate, at least if the department leases the areas in which the industry is ready to work. Price policy is another element of uncertainty in the oil picture, in spite of the dramatic increases in prices we've had in recent months. New supplies are developed on the basis of price and profit expectations, not on the basis of current prices. Even though I would judge present domestic prices for new oil to be adequate, continued control of old oil prices creates doubts and will, in the long run, if continued, either decrease the rate at which new capacity is developed, below that which would otherwise prevail, or require an additional risk premium in the price and consequently a higher price. Petroleum tax policy is still another area of uncertainty. If petroleum prices are free to regulation, then it probably makes little difference to the development of new supply whether potential tax treatment is retained, whether preferential tax treatment is retained or not. And some oil companies are even advocating elimination of the depletion allowance. Probably the most important thing in tax policy with regards to oil is get the policy settled promptly, whichever way the decision goes, so that new investment decisions can be made without the uncertainty brought on by this element. A particularly important policy affecting domestic oil development will be oil import policy. For many years, Middle East oil producers will have the capability to grossly undercut domestic oil in the U.S. market. The need to protect against this contingency is generally voiced in connection with the development of synthetic fuels. However, it is probably even more important as far as domestic crude oil development is concerned. At a given price, domestic oil producers will, if they act rationally, invest less without such protection than they will with it. Having just gotten rid of controls on imported oil, it will be hard to reimpose them, and I doubt if we will. It will probably be easier politically to allow the price of domestic oil to include a risk premium for the possible breakup of the cartel of oil exporting countries. Unfortunately, I'm not predicting the breakup of the